to Reflections on Life. And our guest today, Sean Gladden, who's the executive director of the Howard County Historical Society. But before we hear from Sean, I'm going to go through my regular six topics of reflections that help me keep some sort of an order to my life now that I'm living unemployed and without a very clear, strict schedule. And doing these six reflections every month gives me clarity and also a realization that absolutely everything is connected. So these six topics, as in the past, are home in Columbia, Zachary, my grandson, Baltimore, my hometown, public policy at the local, state, and national level, our planet beyond the U.S., and our universe. So home in Columbia, we have just finished the big celebration of the 50th anniversary of Jim Rouse's creation, Columbia, Maryland. It was an excellent celebration of the arts and of history and of nature and of culture, dancing, music. And the focus on the community college from which we're taping today was a big part of it, because so much of that now takes place at the community college, which has turned out to be an amazing institution. At home in the yard of our townhouse that my husband and I live in, we're definitely seeing signs of spring now. We've seen, although the pond has been iced over and covered with varying degrees of snow, we have seen some of the first signs of spring. We've seen the first pair of ducks show up together and feed on the weeds that are around the edge of the pond that are now being uncovered from the snow. We've also seen the first pair of geese show up and are wondering if this year will be different than the last three. For the first 15 years that we lived in our home, the geese laid eggs and the goslings were born, and they lived to the point where their mother saw them fly off. But in the past 3 years, the snapping turtles in the pond have gotten every one of the baby goslings, so we're hoping for a different result this year, understanding that we are living in nature. And even the first heron has showed up and is very gently stalking along the edge of the pond. So it's a real good material observation for us that spring is definitely here. As always, Zach is in our mind. I was reading the paper the other day, and there was a picture of one of the Temptations who has just died. Not the original Temptations, but he was with them for many, many decades. And I grew up with the Temptations, and I loved the Temptations. And when Zach came along and was a teenager, unbeknownst to me, he and his friends were very immersed in the Temptations and very much loved them. And so whenever I hear the Temptations now, it's a reminder of Zachary. And even at his memorial service that was held when he died, the song that he wanted to have played was My Girl. So Temptations really bring Zachary right back to me. Baltimore, my hometown. We had a good connection to Baltimore right here in the community college this month and last month, and that was with the exhibit about the Cone sisters, who grew up in Baltimore. They were Baltimore women. They were older than my mom, but my mom grew up learning about them. They were great patrons of the art. Matisse was able to get a good start because of the financial support that the Cone sisters gave to him. And so Howard Community College has done an exhibit on them and also premiered a play about the Cone sisters, which I had the opportunity of seeing, and it's excellent. So right here in our Howard Community College, you can learn more about these Cone sisters than probably any other theater anywhere around. And that, I'll mind you, is a 15-minute walk from my house, so we are just so grateful that the college has such a great cultural policy. Public policy at the local, state, and national level. The issue that, of course, in public policy is on every one of our minds, I believe, probably every minute of the day, and that is the freedom with which people can get their hands on guns and automatic, more than just handguns, but the very dangerous ones. And once again, we've had an incredible I don't think it's too melodramatic to call it a massacre down in Florida. But watching these young people from Florida, these teenagers, how they are responding to what they see as inadequacy from the adults who are in positions of power in their community, the way they are standing up, the way they are speaking, the way they are doing it with self-control and laser vision on what their goal is, and that is to see that we put an end to access to assault weapons in our nation. So it will really be something if it is these young people who do that for us. And I'm so, I don't even know what word to use. Impressed is not the word. I'm inspired by the way these young people are, yes, they're grieving, yes, they're mourning, but they're also telling us, my generation and a generation lower than me, my kids' generation, that this is just not going to cut it. You know, we've got to do something about this. So the public policy with gun control, I remember when I became county executive back in 1986, and one of the first calls I got was from Vinnie DeMarco, who's been the volunteer nonprofit advocate for gun control above all others in the state of Maryland. And he asked me if I would sign on and support him an assault weapons ban for Maryland. And I said yes right away. And then he was able to get support from other county executives. The legislature worked very hard on it, but it did not pass. The gun lobby came in, made its threats about money. So I've had some personal experience with that. The other public policy issue that I want to just touch on is we're reading a lot in the paper now about the insecurity of our voting machines. That was also something that I worked on when I was in the legislature with a guy named Avi Rubin, Dr. Avi Rubin from Hopkins Science School, Engineering School, and he was seen as the foremost expert in the world on electronic voting machines. And he said, this is just doesn't cut it. You know, we can't treat a computer with this kind of confidential information. And he taught his class in such a way that suppose he had 10 kids in his class, 5 kids would work on one computer, 5 kids on another identical computer. He would have put, I don't know the correct technical term, so I'm going to say software, into the computer. And he had each class dissect, for lack of a better word, the computer, each one of them, and then restore it. And then they switched computers. Am I making sense? The one group crossed over in the room and went to the other group, took their computer apart, and vice versa, and they could not find. They could not find the, I'm going to say material, again, because of my limited technical vocabulary, on the computer that they had just worked on themselves, and they could not find it. So that's how much can be hidden, and it's just not working. So it's good to see that that question's coming up again. Our planet beyond the U.S., I'm not going to mention any particular country. God knows there are things going on all over the country, all over the globe, some of them positive. But something that's been bugging me for some time, and I've decided to mention it, is how is it that we, the United States of America, get off with calling ourselves America? We are not America. We are the United States of America. Let's call ourselves the U.S. if we want to. But what does that say to our Canadian neighbors? What does it say to our Central American neighbors? What does it say to Mexico? What does it say to Chile and Argentina and Brazil? If anyone can explain that to me, I'd be glad to hear from them. You know, what is it that makes us think we can call ourselves America? We are a wonderful country, but we are not America. And then finally, our universe. I went down with my husband one night to the Robinson Nature Center, which is a county facility, and we had a half hour of absolutely glorious darkness in this room with about 50 theater chairs, and the dome, the whole ceiling of the room is a dome, and it was alive with planets and stars moving around, and with a director who's very knowledgeable about astronomy, pointing out to us, you know, this is Pluto and this is this. And it was just a heavenly evening that reminded me of just how blessed we are to be living here in Howard County, Maryland. So now that we've gone through the universe, let's go back to Sean. I grew up in Baltimore, in Edmondson Village area, and I had an uncle, my father's brother, lived out on Ilchester Road down near the river, and we used to come out to visit him several times a year. Particularly, he had a large, not a farm, but a large hilly lot by the river. And I used to call it Uncle-It City, and it was so exciting to come out here. And as I grew older, I worked as a tour guide for the Bicentennial. I don't know if I've told you that, Sean. A woman named Joetta Cram got a group of women together to give tours of downtown Ellicott City, and I was one of the first tour guides. So Sean is going to talk with us today about the history of Howard County minus Columbia for today. We're going to come back, and the next show will be post-Columbia, about Columbia and what happened in the rest of the county when we had Columbia. So it's great to have you, Sean. One of the things I've been doing in retirement is treating myself to going around to different museums, and you know, I have a very loose schedule, and I've been up to several films and programs at the museum, and I can tell that you're really, it's always been a wonderful museum, but you're really bringing it alive, so it's great to have you here today, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on.
Yeah, it's great to be here, and yeah, we are very proud of what we've done in the last 5 years. I became executive director at the Historical Society in 2013, so this will be, I'm coming up on my fifth year. And now I was trained, I guess you could say, in the Baltimore Museum world. So I had experience at Maryland Historical Society, the Baltimore Museum of Industry, Fells Point, a Maritime Museum, and so I had an opportunity to see the way that some of these organizations conducted their business, how they attracted visitors, and I also had some wonderful. Wonderful teachers in my museum studies program, and certainly through professional development, and we've developed kind of a new approach, I guess you could say, to museums. Is, you know, you gotta, it's more than just having really cool, neat, old stuff in your museums. You gotta do more than just have neat stuff. And so what we're trying to do is supplement our exhibits, our artifacts, with some programming. And that programming has really been bringing in quite a bit of visitation. We had one point had about 1,500 visitors coming to the Historical Society, and last year we were able to increase that number up to 10,000. So just not only having the public programming, but opening up the museum for yoga classes, and it gives people an opportunity to come to the museum.
I didn't know about that one.
Yeah, we do yoga at the museum. Yeah. And everyone who comes to the museum for something that's not related to the museum exhibits, they always wander into the gallery and then tell me how wonderful, you know, not only wonderful the exhibits are, but they learn something new about Howard County, about our wonderful community and its history. So it's been a lot of fun.
That's good.
Can't believe they pay me, but it's great.
You can't believe they pay you. Yeah. Well, you have some very, and you even have musical performances.
We will have, that is
good. So one of the things that comes to my mind, which is not back in the earlier history, but one of my clearest memories of Howard County history when I was alive and paying attention was when Senator Jim Clark and now County Executive Alan Kittleman, who was not elected to anything at that time, walked the Route 40 highway, and to go in and integrate with, and they did it with, I can't remember who it was. I think it was one of the reverends, one of the African American reverends, and possibly it'll come to me before we finish talking about this subject. But they walked the street and went in with this minister and sat down and had a meal together and integrated many of the restaurants along Route 40. Is there anything in the museum that commemorates that?
No, I think there's there has been an effort to try to make some improvements to the message and certainly diversify the museum. And we don't really have an exhibit right now on that period of time. We've kind of focused a little bit more on the 19th century and are kind of working our way up to some more 20th century.
Okay.
However, in the archives, we do have, in the archives, you can come into the archives, which is on the second floor of the Miller Branch Library, and we have, you name it, we've got files on segregation in Howard County. We've got files on Robert Kittleman and Alan Kittleman and... The file on the Clark family is probably a one whole file cabinet in and of itself.
Mm-hmm,
But we certainly have all of the information and certainly have the material related to those stories. I tell you what we did do a couple of years ago, Liz, was we did a program that we were very proud of, which was looking at the 50th anniversary of the desegregation of Howard County Public Schools. And that was 1965.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And actually, Alan came in and talked about his father, and we had the director, who's now the current director of the African American Museum of Culture and History, had come in as well. And I can say that, you know, obviously, as a historical society, I just came from a conference where we had this long conversation about the future of historical societies, and you can't deny that when you hear the word historical society, you think quilt, silver, and white, older white elite families.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, coming from my background, which I did quite a bit of graduate work on African American history, we've done quite a bit to try and change that. We've added some exhibits and some stories. But we have to do more.
That's good. Well, let us go back a little further in history then. The B&O Railroad.
Yes.
The line from Baltimore, Camden Yards out here to Ellicott City. Mm-hmm. The very first railroad.
Yeah, railroad terminus. Yes. Which was was completed in 1830. They didn't actually have rail cars until 1832. Actually, the first passenger cars were horse-drawn in 1830. But the railroad station itself is kind of a part of a larger story, something that we are really promoting at the Historical Society, and that is the importance of the Patapsco River Valley and more specifically the importance of Ellicott Mills and Ellicott City as really the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution.
That must ruffle some feathers up in New England.
Yeah, they probably.
And I know that's not your intention, but I'm.
You know, it's one of those things. We certainly don't want to take anything away from the Samuel Slater factory and all of the wonderful textile mills in and around Lowell and Waltham, and certainly the contributions that the textile industry have towards the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to set your sights 20 years prior to that in the 1770s and what the Ellicott brothers were doing right here in Ellicott Mills. And, you know, even, and this, we're not breaking any new ground, so to speak here. We're just kind of reinterpreting what historians have looked at in the past. The fact that, that there was a burgeoning, wheat trade that was coming, from Baltimore in the, from the times of the Revolution, Up until the 1840s, 1850s, well, the question is where was this wheat coming from? And if you just go outside of into the hinterland, as they used to call it, you got to start with one of those places being Ellicott Mills and the Ellicott brothers coming here in 1772 with the idea that they wanted to open up a mill operation, and they looked around this county and. You know, they were pretty forward thinking guys, and they saw the land around this county and saw that this would be a perfect place to grow wheat. But the problem was most of the farmers around here were growing tobacco.
That's right. And rolling the, what were they called, hogsheads of tobacco?
The hogsheads, that's right.
Rolled down Rolling Road.
That's right.
To the Baltimore Harbor. Yeah.
That's right. And you know, anybody who knows anything about tobacco farming or the history of tobacco farming is it's tough on the soil.
Yep.
The market prices are often fluctuate. So if the market was down for tobacco and you were a tobacco farmer and you know you couldn't sell your tobacco at market, then you were stuck with it. So there was you know, the Ellicott brothers came in and they attempted to convince most of the farmers in this area to switch to wheat. And the first one to really get on board with that was Charles Carroll of Carrollton. Yeah. And so between, you know, and if anyone's familiar with the geography, Ellicott Mills, okay, and then you've got Charles Carroll's property at Doe-Ragan. And if you draw a line from Baltimore all the way out to Frederick, you draw a line directly between those two points. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the basis for the National Road.
Yeah.
And
first
then
road west.
First road west,
mm-hmm.
Which really the National Road was basically an extension of the road from Ellicott Mills out to Charles Carroll's property. Mm-hmm. And then once you develop that market further out west and further to Baltimore, you've basically now have created probably the most lucrative business of the Federalist period, and certainly you can see how it did not only for what was at the time Anne Arundel County, but what it did for Baltimore businesses and Baltimore merchants. So, you know, once Ellicott City, or excuse me, Ellicott Mills at the time, is kind of put on the map as this great, and we now with the recent book that we've put out by Dr. Hal Sharp, Ellicott Mills is really what we call is America's first factory town. And if I can get in a quick plug, on March the 19th, Dr. Sharp will be presenting his book and his lecture at the Miller Branch Library. That is Monday night at 7 o'clock, March the 19th.
I plan to be there.
He is a fascinating speaker, and he if you aren't convinced that we are America's first factory town, you will when
after this
when
huh?
he's done talking. So that's, you know, and obviously with it being the first factory town, it makes sense that it's the first real railroad terminus along the B&O Railroad line. And, you know, the rest is, I guess, as they say, history.
Tom Thumb's history.
Tom Thumb's history.
There you go, Tom Thumb's history. Sean, what should we be looking for in the near future from the museum and in the museum? What do you have cooking down there?
Well, you know, the best way to keep up with everything that's going on at the Howard County Historical Society is to check our website. And our website is www.hchsmd.org. We are located at 8328 Court Avenue. That is at the top of the hill in the First Presbyterian Church next to the courthouse. Our hours are Friday through Sunday, 1 to 5. Phone number is 410-480-3250. If you are social media savvy, then we have a Facebook page, we have a Twitter page, and we have an Instagram page, thanks to my social media coordinator. and obviously, anytime you want to call the Historical Society, we have wonderful volunteers that'd be happy to help. And over the last 5 years, we've made some major changes, improvements to the museum, trying to make it more visitor friendly and get folks in. And I'm working currently with my staff on an Ellicott City Main Street exhibit, which will be framed images from our collection that will depict Ellicott City Main Street going back to the 1880s. And let me tell you, some of those 1880s images are phenomenal. Ellicott City literally looks like a Wild West town. So I think the public will really enjoy that. We had an exhibit last year on the Patapsco. And it was kind of the same thing. It was mostly two-dimensional framed images, and it was just such a, aesthetically, it was wonderful for the museum, and folks really enjoyed coming in and seeing all of these images.
So, I remember it well. I even got my husband, Lloyd, into that one, and he loved it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're trying to do is replicate that, but now give it, you know, some Ellicott City Main Street. Because the thinking is, when folks come in, especially once we get into the tourist months, you know, April, May, June, July, August, September, folks who visit Ellicott City and they see how it is, and then if they know that there's a exhibit up at the top of the hill, they could see how it was. Even for those who aren't locals, you know, we think they'll really find that interesting. And then by September, we want to finish off kind of what we call our exhibit upgrades by really focusing on the founding families of Howard County and going back to, you know, the 1600s and taking it all the way up. And
good.
We have wonderful collections on, you know, you name it, the Clarks, the Shipleys, the Warfields, the Dorseys, the Ellicotts, the Carrolls. And then, you know, so really showing off that part of the collection, but then also kind of telling the stories that probably you know that come along with the founding families, you know, the servants and the slaves who came through and their stories. So it really will be an overview of the history of Howard County, but told through the lens of various families that lived here and founded the county. And as we look around, we have such a unique county. We're one of those counties where, you know, some of those founding families, we still see their names all over the
place.
Governor Warfield Parkway.
Yes, and also we see some of the people. The Dorseys still very involved.
The Clarks.
The Clarks. I sat next to Martha at your Senator Clark's daughter at your program, which, by the way, was excellent on Howard County in World War One.
Yeah.
Excellent program last weekend. Yeah. Well, good. Then we look forward. Yeah. We look forward to that.
And the museum's free, so there should be no reason for everyone listening to this podcast not to come and visit Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 1 to 5.
You can have a good meal at one of the good restaurants and then walk it off and get good exercise walking up the hill to
the hill.
Yeah. Right. Well, I know there have been many people who've worked with the Howard County Historical Society for many years and put their hearts and souls into it and done a lot of good work. But I think some of it all coming together has to do, you have to have some of the credit for that, because I think it really has picked up to where it's not just, I used to see it more as, okay, there's Maryland and there's Baltimore and there's Ellicott City, but it's being brought into the entire East Coast of the United States history now, and I think it's very exciting, and that our kids can go down there and see these places and be able to experience that, I think, is great. So I've enjoyed talking with you a great deal, and we have talked about the fact that we here in Howard County have just finished the year-long celebration of the 50th anniversary of the new town of Columbia that was designed and brought to fruition by our beloved Jim Rouse, and he was a beloved human being. And it seemed like too much to squeeze into one half-hour program, so we'll be inviting you to come back and talk in terms of what not only the history of Columbia itself, which is a part of Howard County, although it's not a municipality. Howard County is one of the counties in Maryland that has no incorporated towns, no municipalities, which actually makes governing a lot easier. So not only that what Columbia was in and of itself, and that was a great deal, but what impact has it had on Howard County and on the entire Baltimore-Washington corridor? And that history we've not finished writing that history because, as you know, there's a lot of additional development going on in downtown and in Columbia. And I think it's really, my point is that it's very important that we keep some of the uniqueness that Jim Rouse brought to that town, and respect for the land and the arts and the way he designed the schools. They were in he picked the best parcel in a community and put the school on the best parcel that was focal to everything, not just, you know, put up the stores, put up the residences, and then, you know, what's left over, put a school on it. So we have quite a community here, and I'm looking forward to its continuing to be a great place to live. And I also want to thank you very much, not just for participating today, but for the great work you're doing up at in Ellicott City, and for looking forward to our talk sometime in the near future.
As a Columbia kid, I am, you know, it's wonderful to come back home and work in the county that you grew up in, and certainly to, you know, talk about a town that I hold in high regard and respect. I mean, I'm raising my kids here, and so it's an honor to be the director of the historic site. It's an honor to talk to you, and I look forward to us chatting about hometown next time.
Okay, good.